Out front next, a record. Early voters about to shatter the one-day record in the state of Georgia. The enthusiasm on the ground tonight palpable, as the latest CNN poll shows Democrat Raphael Warnock with a slight lead just 4 days before Election Day. Plus, House Democrats now in possession of Trump's taxes. So what are they doing with them? I'm going to talk to a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, which has Trump's tax returns tonight. And Chinese police tracking down protesters using cell phone signals in an effort to silence the demonstrators, to target them. This is President Xi Jinping breaks his silence. We're live in Beijing. Let's go out front. And good evening. I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, an all-time record. Early voting in Georgia's pivotal runoff election just ending. And Georgia's elections chief, Gabe Sterling, tells us it will set a one-day record, telling us that more than 300,000 people will have voted just today in the race between the Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and the Republican challenger Herschel Walker. I mean, to say there's a huge amount of interest in this race would be an understatement. I mean, just think about this. Altogether, about 1.5 million people in Georgia have voted early. That is about four times the number of people who voted early in the last midterm runoff. These numbers are incredible. And you can, when I talk about palpable and how you can feel it, just look at what you're seeing here. The record you can see in the lines of polling centers across the state. In fact, in some parts of Georgia, people waited at least 3 hours to cast their vote. Here are some more pictures from just this afternoon where you see these lines of people. And today, we heard from some of them.
I look at politics as a job position. So I look at what each candidate has to offer for the job. And I just feel that Warnock is more polished.
I'm a Republican.
Do you plan to vote for Herschel Walker?
Yes.
There is a lot at stake in this election. Democrats sent in their biggest and best campaigner, former President Obama. And many Democrats feel like the wind may be at their back. Let me just show you this new CNN poll. Warnock leads Walker 52-48%. Only 41% that Walker, who, of course, has been accused of infidelity, violence from former girlfriends, only 41% say he's honest and trustworthy. That number is 52% for Warnock. Now, if Warnock wins next week, here's the thing. It is huge for Democrats. It is huge for the balance of power because it would give Democrats a real majority in the Senate, right? No more Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema controlling the entire Democratic agenda in the Senate. So in the Senate. So this runoff is crucial for Democrats. And Diane Gallagher is out front live in Atlanta tonight. And Diane, I know you have spent the day talking to so many voters. How energized are they about the runoff?
Erin, the voters here in Georgia are dedicated, they are determined, and look, they're overcoming hurdles like those long wait times, like the compressed early voting schedule to make sure that their voices are heard. They told me that they understand that technically the balance of the Senate doesn't necessarily hang on Georgia anymore, but they say that they understand from people who support both candidates, just how much this race impacts not just the nation, but the future for people in Georgia for the next 6 years.
I've never seen it like this.
Long lines once again wrapping around polling places.
I started around the corner.
As voters go above, waiting hours.
About 2 hours.
It's pretty much the same thing, the lines wrapped around the building.
And beyond.
Yeah. My absentee ballot didn't arrive in Massachusetts, so I had to fly here this morning to vote, and my flight is at 4 o'clock, so I'm heading back to the airport.
You do what you gotta do, baby.
Just to cast their ballots early in Georgia's Senate runoff election.
As long as it takes, because I know how important it is for my vote to be counted.
Making a choice, most for the second time, between the Democrat, Senator Raphael Warnock, and Republican, Herschel Walker.
If they don't steal the race from Herschel Walker, he will win.
I'm going to vote for Warnock.
Both candidates on the campaign trail Friday.
Let's hear it for the voters of Georgia who are turning out.
Convincing voters to get to the polls today or make a plan to do it on Tuesday while they deliver their closing messages.
I love this country. I love you guys.
A new CNN poll shows a tight race, with Warnock holding a narrow 52% to 48% lead over Walker among likely runoff voters. While Warnock confronts national headwinds, negative views of Walker appear to be a drag on his candidacy, with 52% of likely voters saying Warnock is well qualified to serve as a senator, but just 27% saying that for Walker.
No candidate's perfect, so I think it's really important to go with the party at this point in time.
Through Thursday, nearly 1.5 million Georgians had already cast ballots, breaking records for the most votes in a single day of early voting this week. But overall, Georgia is not on pace to reach the 2021 runoff early vote total, with the state's new voting law reducing the number of days of early voting in this year's runoff.
It's not enough. They should at least extend it for 10 days.
Still, voters say they are encouraged by the number of people showing up to be heard, even if it means for some spending hundreds of dollars on a three-hour flight to do it.
I was an election monitor in South Africa in 1994 when Mandela got elected, and I watched those South Africans stand in line for 3 days. And I came home saying, I will never not vote again in life.
Now, there are still a few people in the line at the polling place behind me here waiting to vote, because it is the law. If you're in line when polls close and you stay in line, you get to vote. But look, early voting is done today. So both of the campaigns turning their attention to those voters who didn't show up this week, who they need to show up on election day. Erin.
All right. Diane, thank you very much. And amazing, as you see behind Diane, the line she referenced, right? More than 2 hours after polls closed, they're still waiting in line to have their votes heard. It is really incredible what we're seeing. All right. Thanks so much to Diane, who's on the ground there. And now let's go to two people who know Georgia politics inside and out there. Bill Nygut is the executive producer and host of Georgia Public Broadcasting's Political Rewind. He's covered Georgia politics for more than four decades. And Maya King joins me, based in Georgia, covering the race for The New York Times. So thanks so much to both of you. Maya, I want to start with these record early voting numbers. And I was truly struck by that line behind Diane, right? This is 2 hours and 7 minutes. They're waiting because these lines have been long. Obviously, we wish there weren't long lines, but they do show how much people care. And you've been talking to so many of these voters. What are they telling you about why they are so energized, why they are willing to wait hours to vote early?
Well, voters in Georgia understand the stakes, and this is not their first time voting in a runoff election. So for Democrats, this is, of course, a vote for Raphael Warnock, but it's just as much a vote against Herschel Walker. There's a lot of energy on the ground, particularly in these deep blue metro Atlanta counties, to vote against a candidate in Walker who they see as someone who is backed by former President Donald Trump, carries a lot of baggage, and to support now a full six-year term for Senator Raphael Warnock. And I think that just can't be discounted, that voters in Georgia really see this yet again as an all-important, crucial election. As you mentioned earlier, of course, the decision of who will control the Senate has already been decided. But in the minds of voters, having a 51st seat for Democrats is extremely important. And for Republicans, being a firewall against Democrats' control of the Senate is just as important. And that's why you see lines that last 2 and 3 hours, because you have both parties now completely dug in to elect their candidate of choice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it is important, as you say, it's not control of the Senate, but, you know, everyone's seen the past few years here, right? Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin have wielded such power because of the split of the Senate. So this puts that on the line. And Bill, you know, a new CNN poll shows Warnock has a 25 percentage point edge over Walker on the question of qualifications, over whether he's well qualified to be a senator, a 17-point percentage edge on the question of who has good judgment. Yet when it comes to the polls that are out there, Walker is still neck and neck with Warnock when it comes to who people are going to vote for. So from what you're seeing and hearing on the ground and on your show, is this race still that close?
Yeah, I think it probably is. The CNN poll, I think you pointed out one of the most interesting aspects of that poll. You asked whether which of the two are well qualified. At 52% said that Raphael Warnock is well qualified to serve in the U.S. Senate. Only 27% said Herschel Walker. And yet it is the celebrity, the fame of Herschel Walker, and the fact that there's still a strong Republican voting base here that is keeping him in the running. But I would make one other quick point.
Yeah.
It's been inspiring to see the early voters turn out in the state of Georgia at a time when there's so much talk about threats to democracy, whether we can trust elections. Almost 2 million people now are voting early in Georgia because they believe that democracy really does work and their vote counts.
Yeah, and it is amazing. I mean, you know, it's Gabe Sterling saying that the numbers today he thinks are going to settle at more than 300,000 people just today voting early. I mean, it's stunning. And my, I talked to the Republican governor of your state, Lieutenant Governor of your state, Jeff Duncan, last night. So he waited an hour in line. He left his ballot blank. Now, he knew he was going to do that, but he thinks it's important to vote, right, in some way. So he went and did that. But he is the Republican lieutenant governor of your state, right? Elected Republican lieutenant governor. And he could not vote for Herschel Walker. And here's why.
Herschel Walker is going to go down as probably the worst Republican candidate in the history of politics, right? It's just no way to run away from that.
Okay, so how do you really feel, Jeff Duncan? Okay, Maya, so look, but he just came out and said it. Are you hearing this from other Republicans?
Well, you know, it's a tricky question, Aaron, because what you're seeing, at least from the lieutenant governor, is a reflection of what a lot of Republicans are feeling, that if Herschel Walker does lose this race, they'll have to do yet again more soul searching on this question of candidate quality. But it's outside of just what I've heard from voters who do have concerns, conservative voters, about Herschel Walker, you saw this borne out in the results of the general election. More than 200,000 voters cast ballots for Governor Brian Kemp, who wanted to reelect a Republican to statewide leadership, but they did not cast ballots for Herschel Walker. So there's this real gap, I think, among conservative voters in Georgia who do want to see conservative leadership, but just have real qualms about whether or not that extends to the United States Senate when Walker is the person who is the standard bearer for that office.
And Bill, what are you hearing? You know, but Herschel Walker is going down as probably the worst Republican candidate in the history of politics, quoting Jeff Duncan. Well, are you hearing this from other Republicans?
I think it's safe to say he's a flawed candidate. At one point, he actually said he knows he's not that smart, which is not the sort of thing you typically hear from a candidate for the U.S. Senate. But I think there's something really important to keep in mind as you're watching all the early voting unfold, even right now. And that is, it's important for Democrats to run up the score on early voting because Republicans will show up on Election Day. And on Election Day, Herschel Walker got 225,000 more votes than Raphael Warnock had gotten on Election Day itself. So Democrats need these early voters to come to the polls to create a cushion for what they think will be a Republican outpouring on Election Day itself.
All right. Thank you both very much. Such a crucial election. And I want everyone to know on Tuesday, we do have special coverage of Election Day in Georgia. I'll be here along with Wolf Blitzer starting at 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern. Well, out front next, the House Ways and Means Committee now has Trump's tax returns. After a years-long battle with the former president, they've got them in hand, but the clock is ticking. And one of the members of the committee is out front next. Plus, Chinese leader Xi Jinping finally addressing the protests that have rocked China. Who is he blaming? And is he going to open up restrictions on COVID? We're live in Beijing. And we're going to take you live to the world's largest volcano erupting right now, threatening now a major Hawaii highway. Tonight, Trump's tax returns are now in the hands of House Democrats on the Ways and Means Committee. Look, this is a huge step. It was a years-long battle to get these tax returns, right, that no one's ever seen. They cover 6 years of former President Trump's taxes, information about his personal finances, his corporate entities. This is crucial stuff. And out front now is the Democratic Congressman Lloyd Doggett, the member of the House Ways and Means Committee, who our viewers know has been talking to us about this. Congressman, you know, I spoke with you the night that the Supreme Court gave you the green light, finally clearing the way for your committee to get Trump's taxes. Here we are 10 days later. Your committee's got them in hand. What is the committee doing with them right now?
Well, Aaron, finally, after making the motion in February of 2017, almost 5 years ago, the Ways and Means Chairman has access to those returns, to some of the returns that I was seeking at that time. We had a meeting yesterday. He explained the process. He indicated that he did have access to them, that he had appointed some staff individuals, his agents, to go through the returns. I believe that is occurring right now. It needs to occur very expeditiously because we know we have only a few days left in which Democrats would be in charge of this. And we know how much obstruction, 2 years from congressional Republicans, and then this case sat for 2.5 years with a Trump-appointed judge. So finally, we have it. We need to then meet in executive session to hear what these individuals who've been reviewing the returns find and make a determination about how much, if at all, is made public.
All right. So I want to ask you about the public part of this. But first, when you say only a few days, obviously January 3rd, right, is when the gavel switches over. So
exactly.
And not many of those days are in session. But when we spoke, you had said, look, you were willing to have this go around the clock, work on the weekends, work 14 hours a day, whatever it took. Is that happening?
I'm hopeful that it is. We've been provided as members of the committee very few details about how this exploration is occurring. But I think from talking with Chairman Neal, while he's very prudent about following the law and protecting privacy here, he knows how urgent this is, and that come January 3rd, he will no longer be chair, unfortunately, of the committee, and that the work has to be done before that. And I think he recognizes the responsibility to the public and to our committee to come up with an answer. So I feel we'll have, whether in person by Zoom, a meeting of our committee in executive private session. There we will determine what to do with the outcome. It is best to look and get the results, but the more I learn about this case, the more I'm convinced that at this late moment, we really do need to make all or a substantial portion of this available to the public.
So then that gets me exactly what I wanted to ask you. So how does that happen? Because obviously you can do what you can do. If you can't finish it or come to conclusions, right, the best way to get it into, to have it not disappear, which it will, right, if Republicans take over the committee and it stays in committee, is to put it in the public eye. Is that going to happen?
Well, you're exactly right, because all of the Republicans who are talking about being on the Ways and Means Committee chairmanship have already worked to obstruct our access to this and have made clear they want to have nothing to do with this beginning on January 3rd. The way it could occur is in an executive private session, we decide to report this to the House and attach some or all of the returns or return information to that report. Thereby, it could become public. It will take a vote of our committee.
But you could do that by January 3rd?
Yes, we could.
All right. Thank you very much, Congressman Doggett. I appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you very much, Erin.
A next police state, China's security forces now using cell phone signals to try to track down anyone who was protesting, who dared to criticize Xi Jinping's COVID policies. We're live in Beijing. Plus, packages soaked in blood with animal body parts sent to Ukrainian embassies. In an exclusive interview, a top Ukrainian official tells us who he thinks is behind it. Tonight, surveillance state. China's police state using cell phone signals recorded in the vicinity of protest sites to track, to confront, to detain anyone who was there. Right, saying that they were there, then that means they were defying the communist government. It comes as new images are emerging of unrest in Beijing, residents attempting to cut metal chains, trying to break free from lockdown. You literally see that there, right, as they're trying to break free through those bars. In Hangzhou, a man is refusing to go to a quarantine facility. That's what you see here, clinging to his couch, grabbing onto it, refusing to move as those authorities in hazmat suits are literally wrestling to try to drag him out of his home. And just to think about this, someone in their apartment, look at this. It's like you're watching some sort of a movie. And in Chengdu, others raging against the government.
Why is it that every time we speak a sentence of truth, my friends tell me to be careful, that I could go to jail for several years. In this day and age, why? Is CCP the mafia? Why not let people speak the truth?
Source telling CNN tonight, the Chinese President Xi Jinping finally addressed the unrest in his first known comment since the protests. Xi saying the uprisings are, quote, mainly students who are frustrated after 3 years of COVID. Tonight, the government says it's taking some small steps towards easing restrictions. But is this just lip service? Is this going to quiet the protests? I want to go out front now to the New York Times China correspondent Vivian Wang. She is in Beijing, has been covering all of this. And Vivian, you know, from what you've seen and experienced, you know, I sort of just sticking out here, the authorities are using those cell phone data to track protesters. It just sort of like, wow, right? That one demonstrator is telling us they got a phone call this week from a police officer. He said, I'm calling you because we tracked you down. Your cell phone signal was near a protest site in Beijing. What more are you learning about tactics being used by the police?
We're seeing a mix of sort of high-tech technology like cell phone signal, like facial recognition technology, and also old-fashioned tactics. So we've heard reports of police simply stopping people walking by on the street, asking to search their cell phones and seeing if they have foreign messaging apps. We saw at the Beijing protest I was at on Sunday that they were filming participants and using that as a method to track them down later. So it's a mixture of high tech and very old fashioned brute policing.
It's incredible. You know, that image also of the man on his couch, you know, and the two authorities in hazmat suits literally fighting with him, wrestling to bring him out of his apartment. You know, you have been covering the story extensively from Beijing, right? You've been living there with the lockdown itself. And now they say they're easing some restrictions. So are these notable restrictions? Is this going to be enough to satisfy the protesters that you've been speaking to?
You know, it's hard to say to all of your questions. I mean, they are notable easings in the sense that people's lives are going to get easier. In Beijing, for example, you no longer need a COVID test in the last 48 hours to get on public transit. At the same time, that by no means means that zero COVID is gone. There are still a lot of travel restrictions in place. It just feels like a significant easing because there were so many restrictions before. And as for whether it'll satisfy the protesters, that's also hard to say. I mean, it's a very disparate group with a lot of demands. It will probably blunt some anger among people who are primarily angry about zero COVID. But for the people with broader demands about democracy and freedom of speech, probably not. And so it's very hard to say where this goes from here.
Yeah. All right. Well, Vivian, thank you very much. Appreciate your sharing your reporting for us. As you said, Vivian right now is in Beijing. And I want to go now to Sulin Wong. She's a journalist for The Economist and host of The Prince, which is an 8-episode podcast about China's leader Xi Jinping. And Sulin, look, you know the Chinese president Xi Jinping better than anyone, right? You've done such extensive reporting. How surprised do you think he has been by the protests that we've seen around China?
I mean, those protests that we saw over the last weekend were absolutely extraordinary, just given the fact it's so dangerous and so difficult to protest in China. As Vivian was just saying, you know, people can really pay very, very high price for protesting in Xi Jinping's China. But what's also important to remember is that, you know, it was a couple of hundred people, a couple of thousand people in multiple cities, and there's a country of 1.4 billion people. So, you know, from Xi Jinping's perspective, those protests were definitely something he was paying attention to, but you know, it was a handful of Chinese venting their anger and frustration in a country of 1.4 billion people.
And you know, the images that keep coming out, though, they really are. It is amazing to sort of think, gosh, we're living on the same planet. I mean, let me just play another video for you. And I know you've seen so many of these, obviously, Sulin, because you know you're living and breathing this. But this was posted just this week. Hazmat clad workers spraying clouds of disinfectant on a building, right? This is still a common sight all over China. Brings us back to, you know, the first days here in the beginning of 2020 in Wuhan. Experts have said the transmission of the virus via contaminated surfaces is exceptionally low, right? This exercise seems largely pointless. Why do you think Xi is still doing things like this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And those videos really are very, very odd, I think, for most of the world to see in 2022. I mean, it kind of harks back to the early days of the pandemic where people were spraying their vegetables when they came home from the supermarket. But we now know that the transmission through those kinds of objects is incredibly low. So I think what's really important to remember in Xi Jinping's China is that it's all about loyalty. So if you are a Chinese Communist Party official or a Chinese Communist Party member, it's most important that you show you are being loyal to Xi Jinping and the orders of the Chinese Communist Party. And up until now, that has been all about this zero COVID policy. And so you have been being told, make sure that you keep cases in your district, in your town, in your city, down to zero. And that's why you see images like this of people in hazmat suits spraying, you know, doors and all kinds of inanimate objects that are seem like very, very odd behavior. But what's important to remember is that this is all about showing loyalty to the Chinese Communist Party.
Wow. This is sort of like the videos for the audience of one. It is stunning to see this and to see what we're watching unfold. Su-Lin, thank you so much. I'm so glad to have the chance to speak to you.
Thank you very much.
And next, Ukraine claiming Russia is now attacking the country with nuclear-capable missiles, as Russians are now speaking out to CNN. And you're going to hear what they are having to say 8 months in about what's happening on the ground in Ukraine. Plus, also tonight, Trump's former top lawyers appearing before the DOJ grand jury after a judge ordered them to give additional testimony. The order was yesterday. They were there today. Trump's former White House lawyer Ty Cobb is back with me. Tonight, Ukraine says Russia is now attacking the country with nuclear-capable missiles. And in a few moments, you're going to hear from a top Ukrainian official about the importance of that. It comes as some Russians are now speaking out, frustrated by what they're seeing on the ground in Ukraine and now suffering at home. We begin with that and Fred Plykin, who is out front in Moscow.
As Moscow lights up for the holiday season, the festive mood is dampened by a dose of melancholy, as there seems no end in sight to what the Kremlin calls its special military operation in Ukraine.
I think the operation is not going too well, to put it mildly, because there are many losses on our side.
I don't know what the goal of the operation is, but it's not reaching it.
After Russian forces were forced to retreat from large parts of northeastern and southern Ukraine, many here don't even want to talk about what's happening on the battlefield.
To this question, I don't know what to say.
This is a provocative question. I don't want to answer it.
Even after the Kremlin ordered a partial mobilization, drafting around 300,000 Russians between September and early November, gains have been hard to come by for Moscow's forces in Ukraine. Still, many Russians say they trust their leadership's decision-making.
As far as the military operation goes, I can only say one thing, that it is underway, and that I should not comment on it, because we all support our president of the Russian Federation.
And Russian President Vladimir Putin is asking for more support and patience, promising things will turn around.
We, as all of you here rightfully said, we must achieve our goals, and we will achieve them in the end.
But increasing numbers of boarded-up shops show Russia's economy is running out of steam as sanctions bite and some goods are becoming scarce.
Of course, many things we've grown used to buying have disappeared, but life goes on. We have to adjust somehow.
Economic expert Sergei Zhavoronkov tells me he fears the economic woes could lead to wider discontent.
It is a known effect. A short victorious war may provoke enthusiasm. But if the war lasts endlessly and does not lead to the desired outcome, comes disappointment.
For now, the lights remain bright in Moscow, even as the dark clouds of economic uncertainty loom over the Russian capital.
And you know, Aaron, that's one of the things that many people we speak to say gets to them the most, is that uncertainty as far as the economy is concerned. A lot of them say they simply don't know what's going to be in a month, in 2 months, or in 3 months. Are they still going to have a job? How much is their money still going to be worth then? A lot of them also say they quite frankly don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. They think the sanctions are going to be in place for a very long time. Now, Vladimir Putin, of course, has said that he believes that this country's economy will continue to stabilize, but he also says that those combat operations in Ukraine are going to continue until he's achieved all of his goals there, Aaron.
All right, Fred, thank you very much from Moscow tonight. Really just incredible and so compelling to watch people people there speak, what they're willing to say, what seems coded, but just crucial reporting. And now the story about those nuclear-capable missiles. Ukraine says Russia is now attacking the country with nuclear-capable missiles. Fragments of some of them fitted with non-explosive warheads have been collected by the Ukrainian military, which says that Russia is deploying them to exhaust Ukraine's air defenses, you know, just sending them in, even though they're sort of dummies in this instance, to waste the air defense. It comes as the Ukrainian foreign minister speaks exclusively to CNN and says that Russia is likely behind packages with animal body parts that have been sent to Ukrainian embassies across Europe, a macabre and bizarre situation, more than a dozen blood-soaked parcels containing things like pig and cow eyes sent to Ukrainian consulates and embassies, coming in the wake of several explosive letters mailed to the Ukrainian and American embassies in Spain. Matthew Chance is out front. He is live tonight in Kyiv. And Matthew, this is, as I said, macabre and bizarre and disgusting and terrifying, right? Explosive devices. What more did the Ukrainian foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, tell you in your exclusive conversation?
Yeah, Aaron, hey. Look, I mean, the foreign minister clearly very disturbed by these multiple incidents that they've been recording across Europe with their embassies regarding letters and parcels packed with, in one instance, explosives, in another case, animal parts as well. It is, you know, really grisly. Let Dmytro Kuleba, the foreign minister of Ukraine, explain.
Well, it started with an explosion at the embassy of Ukraine in Spain, but what followed was this explosion was more weird, and I would even say sick, because we started receiving letters with eyes, animal eyes, cut off.
Animal eyes?
Animal eyes, yes. In some cases, in one case, it's most probably an eye of a cow and an eye of a pig in another case.
Let me ask you, who do you suspect, who does Ukraine suspect of being behind this?
Well, of course, I feel tempted to say, to name Russia straight away, because first of all, you have to answer the question who benefits from that. And it's definitely this campaign is aimed at sowing fear and terrorizing Ukrainian diplomats. I think it's either Russia itself or someone who sympathizes the Russian cause.
Aaron, for Russia's part, there's been no reaction to our requests for a response to those allegations. But what the Ukrainians say is that there is an investigation underway in the various locations where the letters were received, and they are determined, they say, to get to the bottom of this.
It's absolutely bizarre and disturbing. Matthew, thank you very much. From Kyiv tonight. And next, the former White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, appearing before a grand jury today in the courthouse for 6 hours. This after the ruling came yesterday that he had to come. Next day, he's there for 6 hours. Is the DOJ close to an indictment? Trump's former lawyer, Ty Cobb, is out front next. Plus, we're going to take you live to the world's largest active volcano right now erupting in Hawaii. The lava oozing now towards a major highway. Tonight, the former Trump White House lawyers Pat Cipollone and Patrick Philbin testifying before the grand jury in the DOJ's January 6th investigation. Cipollone was at the courthouse for more than 6 hours today. His former deputy, Mr. Philbin, seen leaving about 4 hours after he arrived. This comes after a federal judge rejected Trump's claims of executive privilege over their testimony. So they brought him back. They brought him back the next day, and there they were. For 6 hours in one case, 4 hours in the other. Back out front now, Ty Cobb, the former Trump White House lawyer. And Ty, all right, so they appear before the grand jury just one day after a judge ordered them to give additional testimony, right? They didn't, and it's a Friday. They didn't wait till Monday.
Right.
They did it the next day. They brought him in. What does this tell you about how fast this is moving?
Well, I think it is moving very deliberately. And I think almost contemporaneous order than testimony suggests that everybody expected this order. I'm sure they were fully prepared. Keep in mind that these two gentlemen, are both serious lawyers. Obviously, from the evidence that we have so far, it's clear that they well advised Trump to avoid the January 6th travails and the Eastman legal arguments and all the clinging to power stuff. So I think it's important to get their evidence in. It's not that, you know, it's not that they were resisting testifying. It's that Trump had asserted executive privilege over certain things, claiming that they shouldn't be allowed to talk to it. You know, the judge rejects Trump's executive privilege claim based on the prevailing legal standard that they have important evidence and it's not otherwise accessible. And that allows them to cooperate, as I'm sure they otherwise would have done.
Right, right. And of course, and the DOJ moves with great alacrity.
I think that's telling. I think we'll see Pence, Vice President Pence, testify before the grand jury as well.
Well, and you think this and that, do you think will be soon? I mean, that obviously would be a significant step.
Yes. I mean, it will require a court order rejecting Trump's claims of executive privilege. I fully suspect that the vice president, former vice president, will end up before the grand jury and provide truthful testimony with regard to the courageous things he did on January 6th.
So I know that you believe that they've got what they need. Obviously, there's now a special counsel involved, but that they've had what they need on the Mar-a-Lago documents case for quite some time. They could indict whenever they're ready to indict. But they haven't yet. But I'm curious when you think they'll do that. And separately, and the question is, it is separate, but will it come together? Do you think we'll see an indictment in the DOJ criminal investigation into January 6th?
So I do believe the Mar-a-Lago is events are, you know, tied up with a ribbon at this stage of the game and could be indicted any time. With regard to January 6th, I've always thought that was the most serious set of circumstances. The legal theories, seditious conspiracy, et cetera. Some of those are a little bit difficult to make out. In fact, in the Oath Keepers case, the Justice Department's evidence was presented in a way that suggested that Trump was purely collateral to the assault on the Capitol. And it doesn't look like DOJ is trying too hard to put together a seditious conspiracy case as to the president. But certainly in terms of obstructing a proceeding, the Pence proceeding, and you know, the scheme of false electors and other attempts to cling to power through the arguments put forth by, Giuliani and the crew that litigated several things, including in Atlanta. I think that case can be built. I think that's a worthy charge because it's unprecedented in American history and should never happen again. So I've always felt that was a more serious thing and an appropriate focus for the efforts of the Justice Department. But Trump's bumbling of the Mar-a-Lago events and inability to put forth any coherent legal theories that would justify a defense has only emboldened the government and made that case much more likely.
All right. Well, Ty Cobb, thank you very much. As always, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Aaron.
And next, the lava from the world's largest active volcano now threatening in Hawaii. We're going to take you there next. Tonight, eruption. Lava from the Mauna Loa volcano is threatening to cut off a major highway on the Big Island of Hawaii. It is the world's largest volcano. It began erupting earlier this week. This is amazing to see. At times, spewing lava more than 100 feet in the air. And our David Culver is there, live, on the Big Island. Or David, this is just amazing. You have a front row seat to this.
Yeah, I do. And arriving at a place where you have not one, but two active volcanoes, because this is just one of them, is a bit strange to see how normal everyone is, Aaron, and how relaxed they are. But it's really kind of the Hawaiian vibe. And this is the most active behind me. This is Fissure 3. And this is where that threatening lava is really making its way, very slowly, we should point out, but making its way towards behind the camera. It's just behind the camera where we have that major thoroughfare. So the real concern is that it could cut off much of this island and create a logistical nightmare when it comes to transportation. But right now, there's no imminent concern. And they do believe they'll have enough time, given how slowly it's moving, so as to be able to warn folks well in advance. But if you look behind me here, it's a bit covered right now. We're starting to see this in all sorts of elements, including now rain and rather cold rain as it's coming down. And it's starting to interact with some of the lava that's already on the ground. You may be able to see it pretty faint out there, but it's pretty incredible. And that's what's brought folks really throughout the day and at all hours.
Yeah, peering behind you, it is amazing, too, just to see that, you know, that sort of old lava field and the sort of wasteland feel of it. You just see the power spewing out, right? It's unbelievable. And then as it lands, you're saying it then moves slowly. And I know it could take quite some time before it reaches the major highway where you are. But what are the other concerns?
Yeah, not just what's on the ground, but also what's up in the air. And it's what looks like smog, but it's called VOG. That's the volcanic smog version. And it's not plumes of smoke. That's what experts try to stress. And they've been stressing that here, officials in particular. These are acidic gases. So they're very toxic. They're very dangerous, especially if they start to spread widely. And so that's what they're monitoring really closely. And they're certainly advising folks who have respiratory issues to keep a distance. And they do plan to widen that advisory if it becomes increasingly dangerous. But as of now, they're confident that there's no imminent danger, so folks can just take it in for its beauty, Aaron.
I mean, it is. And just we're looking at an image taken yesterday on the screen as you're speaking. It is a thing of power.
Yeah.
You can't look at it and not feel awe. Thank you so much, David.
It's humbling.
Reporting live from Hawaii. Thanks to all of you for being with us. It's time now for AC 360.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.